Welcome to this episode of Screen Divers, where Umba, Ricky, and Steve are taking you back to 1987. We are covering The Untouchables, an endless, timeless classic.
Hello, I am Ricky. How are you doing?
Hey, guys, and I'm Steve.
Here you go. We're all here. So, this little movie was directed by Brian De Palma and distributed by Paramount Pictures. It's a crime tale, and it's a damn good one. I enjoyed every moment of
this. Oh, my God.
This.
I really enjoyed sitting down watching it with you this week.
Ricky?
I equally enjoyed it. Probably not to the same extent as you guys, but we'll talk more about that.
No, it's we know that, obviously, this is based on both a book and the 1959 TV series.
Yep. Oh, it was a TV series. I didn't know
that. Yeah, it's a TV series. And we know how it differs from both those other medias, or mediums, I should say. Mm. But great all round popcorn movie which really did bring in the box office. I think it was the sixth highest grossing movie of that year.
It made a lot of money. I think it cost about $25 million to make, and it made, you know, four times the amount.
Yeah.
So not to mention the fact that, you know, it's an Oscar nominee.
Well, we're going to talk about only Oscar nominee for that particular actor.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about that. Going to talk about that. The four nominations and one win. We're going to discuss that. But what a cast. What a cast. We've got Kevin Costner playing Elliot Ness, Charles Martin Smith playing Oscar Wallace, who reminded me of Rick Moranis quite a bit.
Yeah.
Is the accountant that gets sent from the FBI, right? And we've got Andy Garcia as George Stone, a Cuban playing an Italian once again. and we got Robert De Niro as Al Capone in a pretty hammy role. But at the same time, to be honest, he method acted his way through this as well.
Yeah, he put on 30 pounds, really stuck to it. And because at the time he was doing a play as well, and it was a bit of a touch and go where he could do that role or not, wasn't
it? Yeah, I think he was coming from The Mission. So it must have been easy to put underweight as well, because he was, you know, on the thinner side for that. Mm. And then we've got Sean Connery as Jim Malone. And, oh boy, does he steal the show.
Yeah.
He really does.
Fantastic.
It's one of those roles that you can see easily why he got the accolades that he did from that role. But there is also so many elements to the role that are just so like, how was he allowed to get away with that?
Yeah, I mean, you're Sean acting Connery. Like the Mountie in that scene, man, Ricky.
I don't approve of your methods.
But then we have other character actors in this, and one of them, very underrated actress, her name is Patricia Clarkson.
Yes.
And she's a superstar. She plays Ness's wife. I mean, it's a small role because we don't see her on screen that much, but I'm rewatching Frasier, as you guys know, over and over. I'm obsessed with the show. And she's in that. Yeah, wasn't she in Sideways as well, opposite Sandra Hall? With I think maybe. Can someone check?
Well, sure. I can do it now.
But, and we've got quintessentially evil bad guy in this, played by Billy Drago.
I could talk hours about his career.
What a face. He's got a great face.
He's got such an evil face. He does.
All those angular lines on his face, like Levan Cleef kind of thing. He's got this, you know, sharp edges. It's all sharp edges.
I am happy to say I did a big deep dive through many interviews with him about his career. And he's an actor that as soon as you recognize who he is, and you start watching all of these great old films, you start picking him at random points for his career, and he plays
Nitty so well, man. This guy, he steals the show whenever he's on screen. This was a big movie, man. This is at the height of Kevin Costner being a superstar, like a complete superstar. We're talking Dancing with Wolves. We're talking the Bodyguard. We're talking Waterworld. All right,
Waterworld.
Again,
Waterworld.
I'm gonna keep mentioning this movie because people perceive it as a flop. It didn't flop, but it cost so much to make because of what happened during the production of that movie. But it's a classic. It's a classic for me. But anyway, I think Steve likes it as well. Ricky, you're on your own on this one.
I feel like I am on my own.
It's a mixed bag of tricks for me.
Who are you, man?
I enjoy the movie, but for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, so that's the cast, and we're going to talk about that later as well. But there's other stuff about this movie. When the movie opens straight away, there are two big names that are not part of the cast.
So you're right. They're not part of the cast.
But they might as well be. Because their work is so present that it's almost.
And just reading their names as the title cards come up is enough to make you go, we're in for a ride here.
And we're going to start talking about who they are. And the first one, one of the first names that pops on screen is Giorgio Armani, which there's a big thing here. So allegedly, because Robert De Niro method acted his way through this role, which, by the way, if it went to anybody else, because it's quite hammy. He takes it over the line, obviously. And he's 10 years older than the Al Capone that he plays anyway. So he has to bring that energy to it, but it all almost goes Dick Tracy. You know, there's a little bit of a caricature of what a gangster was at the time, but they were, you know, they were extreme.
What we have to remember is that Al Capone was a people person. He was single-handedly, you know, running the alcohol and crime business in
He was
Chicago
extremely charismatic, apparently.
But he was also basically feeding soup kitchens at the same time. So you've got to take in that he's playing the atypical gangster, which knows that he's a gangster, but also knows that he's trying to do some good at the same time. But,
absolutely. You just described every organized crime organization and how they operate. Yeah. of course. But here's the kicker. I found out a bit of information I didn't know about because we were riveted when we saw, oh my God, Giorgio Armani. And then we kept remarking how good the costume design is in the show.
They nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, they were. They didn't win. I didn't check who won that year, but they didn't win. However, there's a little bit of a shadow. And that is apparently De Niro went in full method acting mode and he tracked down the tailor, Al Capone's original tailor. His name was Henry Stewart. He was Al Capone's tailor. He was still alive. And De Niro demanded from production, but he asked, he asked for this man, Henry Stewart, to design all of his clothing, basically. Every garment he wore. And if you look at pictures as well, like, for example, the staircase confrontation scene with Ness.
Yes.
That jacket that he's wearing is prominent among most of the photos that you see of Capone from that era. If he was wearing a coat, that's the one he was wearing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But not only that, it's also the person in charge of costume design for the entire department. It's a woman, and her name is Marilyn Vance. Now, I'm glad that I found this info because she worked on over 60 pictures, and some of them are pretty big. So she was in charge of costume design. She designed all of the clothing for, ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Rocketeer.
Oh,
Hudson
yeah.
Hawk.
Right.
Predator. Predator 2. Die Hard. Die Hard 2. Uncle Buck. Roadhouse. Ferris Bueller. Pretty in Pink. Action Jackson. Breakfast Club. 48 Hours. Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And the list goes on and on and on. So Marilyn Vance, phenomenal work. Absolutely phenomenal work. She's not mentioned in the opening credits, or at least I didn't see her name. I saw Giorgio Armani.
Yeah.
And the other big name that we saw as soon as the movie opens is Ennio Morricone.
Of course. Yeah.
Who was one of the nominations for the Oscars, but did not win. And I adore Morricone. Okay. I love him.
Yes, we all know.
Yeah. But he was a bitter man. He's gone. He wasn't a very easy man to work with. In fact, these nominations he did not win, but he ended up in winning two Oscars throughout his entire career, only two. One of them was a lifetime achievement or whatever. I think it was in 2007 he was given that.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's called or what it's referred to. I think it was a honorary award.
Mm.
Honorary award in 2007. But then he ends up in winning for the movie he didn't want to do. He got his Oscar for his work in 2016 for The Hateful Eight. And yep. if you know the story about Tarantino begging Morricone to let him use his music,
yep.
it's because they really wanted to work together. And he refused. He refused several times because he didn't like the... All of a sudden, he had a problem with violence. Like, what? If you look at his entire body of work, it's, you know, I mean, pretty full on.
I mean, the violence in, like, sorry, sidetracking a little bit, but the violence in Hateful Eight is very different to the violence in Tarantino's other films. In terms of the reason I'm saying that is
because, oh, the hanging.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but like a lot of the violence is centered towards a single character repeatedly, but, and it's all
I get what you mean from that perspective. Yeah. Yeah.
Look, my
but anyway, that's a sidetrack.
That's fine. My idea on Morricone changed a little bit when I decided to open my mind a little bit to the reality of things, like. I remember a conversation that took place in Rome last time we visited, not last time, the time before. I think it was about 2019. My uncle is, and his partner is in the world of opera. He's been for many years. His name is Marco Spada. So he knows a lot of opera singers. He knows a lot of about classical music and that entire field of music. So we were talking at the table, we were having dinner, and, you know, all of a sudden I declared my undying love for Morricone, and his face changed. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? So apparently, within that circle, Morricone is not very well respected. And he explained to me why as well. The reason why is because during the 60s, the 70s, if you ended up in making soundtracks or scoring for cinema, that was an exit strategy because you didn't make it as a composer.
Oh.
I didn't know this. And... it's that stigma still carried on. So all the Hans Zimmers, all the Morricones, all the it's one of the things that obviously the world has changed dramatically. But I think Morricone carried that bitterness with him for throughout his life because he still lives in Italy. He still lives in that environment. So well, he's dead now, but it you know what I mean. Like so, until the day he died, he wasn't an easy man to deal with at all, and. There was a lot of anecdotes that he shared at the table, which I'm not going to get into, about how bitter it was. So I'm still glad, but it's funny. It's funny that he got an Oscar for a movie he didn't want to make. You know what I mean? Like, it's... and don't forget, I think, Ricky, you know this, and Steve, I got to see him live.
Yeah.
On one of his last performances at the O2, you know, and it was amazing. In fact... As we were watching The Untouchables, there is a sequence where De Niro is on the balcony.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And he's watching Pagliacci, I think it is.
Yes.
And
it's
an emotionally charged sequence. He's being told something in his ear, but at the same time, he's responding to what's happening, and a single tear comes out. Now, that's the mobs. That's the duality of man and this guy, you know, he just ordered a hit on somebody, basically, and he's crying. When I went to see Morricone, the Ecstasy of Gold, came on, and it's, you know, it's the one where there's the there's an entire vocalization of the there's a soprano. Is it a soprano? No,
soprano's the highest one.
The highest one, is it?
Yeah.
Anyway, how do we get out of this cul-de-sac, man?
I don't know, man.
You started it.
But point of the matter is that I react in a similar way. Like it's because you're overwhelmed with emotion. It's your body reacting that. It's not like have you ever been to see like a 40-piece orchestra or
yes
you have, and 100%. What was your response the first time?
Well,
it's overwhelming.
Yeah, I saw Swan Lake with full orchestra, and it was just amazing.
Well, there you go. I mean, I don't know if you cried, but I cried when I saw Morricone. It just I was like, I actually touched my face. Like, what's happening, Mama? And then I turn around and my friend's crying as well. I was like, what the fuck is going on here? It's because it's overwhelming, I think. Anyway, so two big shots, Marilyn Vance and Ennio Morricone. Marilyn Vance did all of the costume design for Mystery Man.
Of course she did.
Of course.
I'm telling you, like, I didn't know this. It's full on, but she did. and the director of photography of this movie, who should be praised for other reasons.
100%.
Yeah, Stephen Burnham, that's his name. He was also the director of photography.
For Mystery Men.
I was going to say that actually there's a lot more connected between Mystery Men and this film, and it's actually to do with the production. And if you look into like all of the pitfalls that this production had, it could have easily have been another Mystery Men. But I would I was going to say that like if it wasn't for like, you know, that this wasn't Brian De Palma's like first joint, and this was like a big team around it, and you know that they had a producer who was like, no, more money, no, more money, no, you want to take more money out of us, no, we want more money out of you. If it wasn't for all of that, this wouldn't be the film that it is.
Well, yeah, 100%.
And that's fine, but these two movies are completely different animals. But the idea is not only that, they're different studios as well. So I don't know why there's this connecting tissue between the two. It's really weird that they share DNA, and it's one of them is Paramount, which is this. And the other one was Universal, I think, Mystery Man, whatever.
Yep.
But that's it. I mentioned this now. We're not going to talk about Mystery Man anymore. We talked about that for an hour, and that was too long.
Yeah.
So let's really put that experience behind us.
It's gone.
It's done. It's gone. But
I might bring it up again. I'll be honest.
Yeah, okay. Feel free. I'll just leave. That's fine. You guys can talk among yourselves. We took a while for us to get here, but here we are. I gotta ask Ricky to give us an overview of what this movie is about.
Okay, well, this movie is about the 1920s, actually closer to the 1930s, because it starts off with a 1930s little scroll. But it is to do with the fact that Al Capone has now pretty much taken over Chicago, and he is a racketeer during the Prohibition era of America. And he is basically living large. And just as he thinks he's on top of his game, the FBI have decided
to... His theme tune is so good.
It's so good.
Yeah. So good. That fanfare by Morricone. It's called Al Capone, that thing, with the... opulence. We were both... Like, when myself and Steve were watching it, we both looked at each other like, opulence.
Yeah, opulence. Yeah. A bit sleazy opulence.
Oh, yeah.
Very 100%. Sleazy.
Great.
Yeah,
it's like
great.
If nothing really makes this like an 80s film, a lot of the soundtrack makes it very 80s.
It has the elegance of a smoking session in your bedroom when you wake up in the morning with a giant cigar. Imagine the way that room smelled.
And the funny thing is, we've just talked about Al Capone's entrance, but the movie pretty much follows the making of the Untouchable. The Untouchables, the unit that is hired or put together to take down these bootleggers.
We are going, that's what the movie's about. One person that we'll assign this little job to is Steve when it comes down to talking about the veracity of this, like how much of this movie is historical, because there's a lot of it's heavily fictionalized. And that's great, because that makes for a great movie. It is a great movie. Like I really, really enjoyed watching this again. Like I was a kid when I watched it. And strangely enough, some movies will give you an extra gift when you rewatch them, because your life experience has expanded, you're older, you understand. Nothing has changed. I perceived this movie exactly the same way as I did when I was a kid. I didn't learn anything new. There was, you know what I mean? If anything, it tickled the same spots, like the camaraderie among... There's a very adventurous kind of... There's this team spirit, you know, like there's the four of them. When four of them are in the frame, you know, there's an adventure. And possibly, in reality, most of them were behind desks most of the time. Ness and Capone, did they meet, Steve?
Possibly only when Capone was getting the handcuffs put on. That's it, right at the end.
So basically,
they never met. Never met in person to person terms.
You're not even talking a badge. You're not even talking a badge.
It's well, us basically screaming that at the end.
Yeah.
And in my mock,
it was Italian great, man.
Accent. That's fantastic.
Nothing but talking about. So, yeah, Steve read the book. I think I may have read the book years ago because it was a big thing. And that's what we were discussing at the end of the movie when we watched it. It was a big movie. It wasn't just the award nominations, the Academy Award nominations, which obviously, you know, would put something on the map. But at the same time, it is at the height of the game of each one of the members of this cast.
A bit of a snippet to this. Well, once the book was written and published, by the time that it became quite a big thing at the time once it was actually released, Elliot Ness had passed away. He never saw the fruits of it. By the time of its release, he passed away as an alcoholic.
Oh,
let's just say that.
When did he die really exactly? Strong. You guys can get this info.
Oh my god! Yeah,
get this info for a moment.
I do know it, but I can't.
Yeah, let me bring it up.
No. Steve is doing it. Ricky, I got to talk to you about the writing talent of this movie.
Okay.
Because that was the other name that when it popped up on the other, I saw it, I was like, oh shit, it's him.
Yeah.
It's David Mamet.
David Mamet. And David Mamet actually took this job as just a money spinner. He, this script was written previously by Wendy. Now, I'm going to look it up because.
Well, is it the person who has the co-writing credit?
Yeah, but she doesn't get enough credit. Like, her name was removed off the script.
Ah, because I've got an Oscar Fraley here.
Yeah, Oscar Fraley was the guy who helped Elliot Ness
write the book. Okay.
Whereas David Mamet was brought in brought in after the fact. Mm. And it was all very contentious by the sounds of it. If you read, there was a whole David Mamet interview on like the 25th anniversary showing of The Untouchables, which he was interviewed at. And he was just very much like, the money was good. I didn't believe a single word of the book.
It's a job as well.
Like whatever. I got called in afterwards.
Added it to the screen pretty much. That's what this is.
He also said that there was like a lot of things that afterwards he was like, yeah, I didn't really care for that scene, but you know what? They paid me, so.
Fair enough. You know, he's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and he won the Pulitzer for two movies. I don't know the other one. The other one is Speed the Plow, but I know very well the other movie, which will
be at
some point because it's one of my favorite movies of all time, and that's Glengarry Ross.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Absolutely phenomenal dialogue.
Yeah,
that's why you remember David Mamet pretty much. And I think it's akin to this job. He wrote Hannibal.
Yeah, yeah. I was going. So he passed away on the 16th of May, 1957. By the way.
Oh, whoa. So he died 30 years prior to this movie being released. I thought he was dead.
Yeah,
he died.
No. Even the TV series, which was released in 1959.
Oh wow.
Yeah, okay. so the book was released.
You said.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, which is very telling to the last line of when he, what are you going to do after all this is done? When prohibition is gone. And he states, I'm going to have a drink right at the end of the movie. You know?
There's a few one liners like that in this one. Where's Nitty? He's in the car.
It's on akin to Lethal Weapon style one liners. You know, it's like a perfect one. And one of the things I was going to mention as well, Kevin Costner, he was only known for a TV series, that the adventure one, wasn't it? Prior to this.
Yes.
My God.
Now, going back to Mr. Burnham.
Yeah. Okay, Burnham.
Sorry. All right. No, just because, we can't.
We get distracted.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the movie is, it's not a character study. It's a story. It everything in the story services the story. The movie moves forward. The pace is very, very good.
Very quick.
Yeah. And one of the things that I notice is whenever there's good cinematography in it, because of this, you really spot it. So it's not all the way through, but there's a lot of stuff that is also evocative of things you've seen before with De Palma. And I think that's the reason why De Palma has worked with Steven Burnham again. There's one shot in particular that where you get two displays of skill here that I really like. Some people may find it a little bit off-putting, but I really, really enjoyed it. It's in the church. It's when Malone and Ness are in the church.
Oh, yeah.
It's the first time, because obviously Walls have years in this place, and they leave the police station. The, what is it? It's an FBI headquarters or whatever.
No, it's a police station.
It's a police station.
Yeah. They've got an office in a police station.
Yeah, yeah, because they didn't have, like you said, Steve, they didn't have enough funding to have this happen in a particular unit, place for the unit. They had to share space with the police force, right?
So, go ahead.
Yeah, no, what was the funding in the original story? What was the amount of funding that Hoover gave this unit?
So they only give, it wasn't just this unit. It was the entire USA. They only had 1,500 agents.
Whoa. Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's it. Full stop.
Yeah, that's akin to the history of the war on drugs for the United States.
It's like, while supplying them.
Canceled before we even start. Anyway, we're not going to talk about geopolitics because we know nothing. We know as much as we know about opera.
That means very little.
Yes, very little.
So,
wait a second. Let me stay on the cinematography here because there's a couple of things. In that sequence, there's two things that. One of them remarks what you are going to see throughout the movie quite a bit, and then what you are going to see from Steven Burnham's work throughout his career. Because then I started, like, it was evocative. I started thinking about it. It's like, okay, this is how he does it. He's also one of the people that use this quite a lot. There's a lot of low angle shots in this. I don't know if you noticed. Like, for example, whenever you see Capone, he's on purposely, most of the confrontations happen when he's on top of a set, or like a staircase. So he's above everybody else. You know, he's like, he's unreachable. He's
untouchable.
The untouchables. Is it the unit or is it him? But the low angle shots in cinema in general, as you guys know, they always give this. You use a low angle shot when you want to make the character imposing, larger than life, or, you know, and there's a lot of that here. But then something else happens in this, which it kind of threw me off because I haven't seen it in a while. And remember that this is before digital filmmaking. So what they did is they used a split focus diopter set.
Yeah.
Which
I knew you would talk about this.
I adore it because it's not done in post. It's actually shot that way and it throws you off, but it's so De Palma.
Mm.
And it's basically, you see Kevin Costner in focus on one side, like it's a profile shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they're having a conversation and both of them, not only you get this difference in depth and distance between the two characters, both of them are in focus. And there's a lot of skill by Burnham here. He actually has to rein it in a little bit because he doesn't get to play around it. You can't throw, in fact, that sequence stands out quite a bit because
I think it's the only sequence of its kind in that movie.
Yeah.
And deliberately.
Yeah, deliberately. Yeah. Like, it's let me play. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, De Palma and him going, like, come on. Let's. And in fact, De Palma's done this before, most notably in another little movie of his called Carrie.
Yes.
Again, this is not the first time. It's a very cinema d'auteur or whatever. It's a thing that, you know, as a big director, you get to call back to your own work. You know, because you have a style. And even if this was a big blockbuster at the time, it's still very much a De Palma movie.
Oh,
the way the camera moves outside windows, creeping in. There's a bit of giallo. Let's not forget that ultimately De Palma is the most prominent member of the giallo family in the States. Like, his relationship with metal, glass, and blood is incredible. Like, the way Nitti falls through that car and the glass shatters.
Oh, my God.
It's like a Dario Argento movie, man. There's a very... In fact, I kept turning around to Steve to go, man, his relationship with glass is fucked up. it's when glass is breaking, someone's going through it.
Or
someone's going to die. Like, it's there's a lot of that. And just with the camera creeps around a little bit, like the entire sequence with Malone
and
the two guys outside.
so
it's,
well
it's
done.
Giallo, yeah. It looks like it's a horror movie. For all of a sudden, it's like you get this slasher kind of vibe.
Well, yeah, it's all connected to like those stuff like Maniac in New York, the New York film Maniac, as well as a few other of those films where...
Well, you could talk about two of the most important Giallos, American Giallos, and one of them is Body Double.
Yes. Body Double, yeah.
And but, the other one is Dressed to Kill. Dressed to Kill.
Oh, my God, I forgot about Dressed to Kill.
Yeah. If you think prior to that, if you think prior to...
But wait a moment, sorry, just a second. Body Double is also shot by Stephen Berner. Same guy.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So go on. Yeah. You were talking, so if you're talking
if you,
about...
If you look at the way that cinema has gone in the US, a lot has got to go with the sort of B-movie style, especially the New York era going from the early 70s, where they just created film after film after film. And of course, it was hook or by crook. It was that grindhouse feature. They knew that they were making these films as cheaply as possible and sticking them together with like a couple of other features for a weekend. Pig, notably, or Don't Go Into That House. And those films all had these like, just get it shot and get it over and done with. And of course, the whole thing about 1970s New York was that, you know, it was during a time where there was no money in New York at all.
You won't go out at night and be safe in certain areas either. Mm-hmm. It's not a Brooklyn or like all these areas that are the Bronx that are sanitized now. They were not
I've got a whole book called Fun City Cinema, and the pictures of New York from 1950s to the 1970s are astounding just because of the amount of rubbish, decay. Most of the buildings are decrepit and falling apart. It took towards the end of the 70s with your what's that film, French Connection and things like that, where they started bringing in the money into New York, Taken of Pelham 1, 2, 3. They started bringing in the money and being like, well, you can shoot here and all of that stuff. Mm. That New York started doing an about face and actually became the city we know now.
Yeah, now it's impossible to get a permit to shoot in this place. Most movies are shot in Canada because of this. But
Vancouver, isn't it? Usually.
Yeah, this movie, by the way, takes place in Chicago, but the two cities that were akin to each other, although Chicago was probably better off money-wise back then.
So
about his body of work as well, we should talk about a little bit about what Burnham has done, besides working with De Palma, because, I'm bringing this up because, Ricky, there's one of your favorite movies. He's D.O.P.,
Go on, because I have
Rumblefish. Rumblefish.
Ah, Rumblefish.
Yeah, you mentioned Rumblefish to me. Yeah, he did Santa Elmo's Fire. He did 8 Million Ways to Die, Al Ashby. He did The Outsiders, again, another Coppola. So, I mean, all these guys knew each other. So, you know.
Yeah.
Casualties of War, which is by De Palma. I forgot. That's another movie where De Palma needs to service the story. But he's got a great cast for it. I want to watch that again because I really enjoyed that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
It was off the tail of bigger movies like Platoon,
Hamburger Hill.
But this falls, it was more like, okay, you'd know nothing about this war because you're a teenager, but I'll give you two actors that you're into and I'll throw them into this world. And that's Casualties of War.
Yeah, that is Casualties of War.
Yeah. And Khalil's Way as well, which we discussed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's worked. Mission Impossible.
This is exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah. It's De Palma?
De Palma.
What the fuck?
The original Mission Impossible is De Palma.
Yeah. DOP as well,
Same DOP, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm... I know.
And then did you say Snake Eyes?
Snake Eyes? Yeah. Okay,
come on,
that's a piece of shit. But anyway...
It's a brilliant
piece of shit.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant piece of shit.
Especially, again, okay. you know my love
listeners,
of actors.
I'll put this out there. I'm going to fire these two very soon because I'm in the position to firing them. I'm not. If you would like to join our podcast, please, because you may have a better taste in fucking movies.
Right.
What is going on here? No. Anyway,
Look, you can't... A film that, again, I know this is like my little kink, but a film ending with one of the main characters looking straight into the camera, bloodied, dripping with blood, going, "You got snake eyes." It's amazing. No, it's amazing.
Not the
bees.
Not the bees.
Okay,
oh,
okay.
My God.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Are we going to do like Nicolas Cage quotes for the rest of the episode?
No.
Just, let's just no. do that.
There's too many. We don't have enough time.
I'm a sexist cat.
Okay. All right. I want to talk about the start of this film. Okay. We've already done Al Capone getting the shave. That was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to talk about is actually how slow the start of this film is. So you had the very slowness of, first of all, you had the title, you know, the information about this, the 1930s, blah, blah, blah. And then it was a very slow crane shot down to Al Capone's face. And then he has the interview with the reporter.
Yes.
But reporters. Straight after that, oh, yeah, with reporters, sorry. Straight after that is the slow zoom in with the girl and the shop. And that scene's actually quite slow. It's not a bang, bang, action, dialogue. It's really slow. And then finally, the intro to Elliot Ness, and he doesn't say a word.
Mm.
Those three scenes are probably one of the slowest starts to a movie I've seen in a while. And
but
yet
doesn't
it
affect the
brilliant.
Pacing, though.
It's brilliant. No. Yeah, no. It's brilliant. It was like, and one thing, I've had a conversation with you, Umbar, like to do with like Evil Dead Rise and a lot of films that have come out recently, where things are like too quick. Things are like snap. And this movie proved that you are allowed to have that time and you are allowed to have those moments.
Can I point something out to you? Because I remember saying this to Steve while we were watching it. And it's not like, we discussed about Chekhov's gun and the importance of Chekhov's gun in storytelling, particularly in modern times, because we live in a different era. So I believe that if you have 2 hours to tell a story, if you're making a movie, obviously, you know, the way media is distributed has changed. So character development normally happens best on streaming platforms because you have 10 episodes, 20 episodes, whatever the hell, 10 episodes, let's say, 6 in the UK and 10 for the rest of the world to tell a story. That allows for a lot of character development. You've got 10 hours. You've got plenty of time. But in movies, it's a fallacy not to follow the rule when it comes down to Chekhov's gun. If you are going to give any information whatsoever, it needs to pay off. It needs to be connected and needs to service the story. And in this movie, it's almost a masterclass. There is no filler. And I'll give you an example. You just said it. The opening sequence is Al Capone being shaved. Okay, he's being cut. Okay, yep. And people associate that name as one of the most violent gangsters of all time, right? It's like Al Capone was. There's menace attached with the name, right? He gets cut. He looks at the blood. He has a reaction to it, but he doesn't do anything. And it's
not on screen.
It doesn't do anything on screen. Then the next sequence that we see is the complete opposite. Because you basically see a girl being blown to bits. No fucking consideration whatsoever for collateral damage. And it's the entire sequence with, sir, you forgot your bag. And then the explosion, right? It shows you how disconnected he was from everything.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to be as disconnected as possible from any criminal activity so he wouldn't get busted. But the idea is he was still in charge of everything. So about Chekhov's gun, every sequence needs to make sense. Here there's something that is called back to three times. And the last time it hits it, it's so hard. And it's an address. And the address is 1634 Racine. The next shot we see is, Ness, or the next series of sequences are about Ness realizing how difficult this is, him dealing with the public humiliation of not being able to get to this guy. He knows exactly, the entire city knows exactly who it is and what, but they don't know how to go about it because there's corruption everywhere. So when you work within that system, it becomes very difficult. So he goes and looks outside for help. And after he meets Malone's character, played by Sean Connery, he goes to... there's no sequence in which there's an exchange of addresses, but, he has the resources to find where the guy lives. He finds where Malone lives and goes to his house. And we know immediately that he's going to his house. We're not told this, But all of a sudden, there's something very prominent in the middle of the screen. The entire sequence of him going to Malone's house for the first time opens, slowly panning down, and we're given an address. Why? It's right in the middle of the screen. This is the first 15 minutes of the movie. And it's like, I actually turned around to Steve because I didn't remember this. It's, you know, it's such an important part of the movie, but I completely forgot. And the name of the street is in focus. So it's not on the side of the frame. It's in the middle, right bang on in the middle. Like, as the viewer, I want you to know you have to read this. You are reading this. There's no way that you're going to, it's not just a street sign. You are going to be forced to know this name, the name of this street. And the name of that street is Racine Avenue. And he goes in. The movie goes on. And then we see this street again. We see it when there's the execution of Malone, because that's what it is. It's a full-on execution. And then towards the end, the finale of the movie, we're basically witnessing Elliot Ness getting a reason to kill the guy who killed his friend. And it's the matches, right? The packet of matches. That's what you were talking about?
I was actually going to say, you see that book of matches prior.
Are given these four times. But you don't see that in movies anymore, not to this extent. It wasn't direct. When it happens at the end, that it's, you'll go, oh, shit. Oh, and he even says it. He says, I used to have a friend.
Who do you know? I had a friend on Racine Street. Yeah.
Yeah. And to leave Racine Street alone for the rest of the episode, as I was looking, well, what, I wonder if there's any more significance to this. Guess what show paid homage to this entire thing?
I can't guess.
The Walking Dead. There's a character. I stopped watching The Walking Dead after season 5. There was no reason to watch the show. Yes, The Ones Who Live is very good for anyone listening that is a fan of The Walking Dead. I can tell you, go back and watch the new show. It's, if you miss Rick and Michonne, it's a reason to watch. It's amazing. It's awesome. Let's just say that The Walking Dead kind of insisted upon itself a little bit too much.
Yeah.
But the first 5 seasons are worth watching, in my opinion. And there's a character that we were introduced to, if you fell out of watching the show like I did. A lot of people dropped the show when Rick left, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much same for me.
Because Lincoln's phenomenal in the role, it was a reason to watch the show. Carl.
I still love Carl. Those memes.
And all the memes.
Yeah.
Huh? All the memes, yeah, of course. But there's a character called Eugene. I don't know if you remember Eugene.
Oh, Eugene was from season 2, 3.
Yeah. In the later seasons, apparently there's an episode in 2022 because I know this info because I was looking for it. And he's interrogating a witness to something, and the guy gives an address, and the address he gives is 1634 Racine. It's obviously an homage to the Untouchables. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and that was me. That's it. I'm done with that rant.
So I was going to say we're hitting our timer marks and all of that stuff. So, and we haven't even talked about the Battleship Potemkin homage.
So you know this was shoved in at the last minute because the original plan was to do it on the train.
Yep.
Which was then played in Carlito's Way.
Oh, so, the entire trailer.
That was reused later on. But because they were running out of time and money on the picture.
Yeah, he shot it on location.
He basically
drew the entire sequence on location.
Yeah.
In the Palma. You know,
did you hear how he paid for the film?
No.
So So if you don't know about old technology and all of that stuff, reels and reels of film cost a certain price.
Of course.
When you get towards the end of a reel of film, you've probably got whatever, you've got about 10 meters still left of it. And that normally just gets put away so it doesn't get overexposed or whatever. So De Palma decided, well, we've got all of this extra footage that I'm not going to sell back to Paramount. I'm going to go film my scene. And that's how they got all of that footage of the staircase. All of the cutoffs from the daily rushes that, you know, weren't used. And he was like, yep, no, I've kept them all in a suitcase in the back or whatever. Let's go film this.
Nice one.
Quite literally cut it down to how much film you've got.
Yeah. So they just don't make them like this anymore.
No.
Anyway, trivia, a little bit of trivia. It's too early. We need to talk about Drago. We need to talk about Nitti. Oh, my God. He's so good. Wants to take the lead on this?
I absolutely love this guy. He's in Pale Rider, but most notably, he's in a lot of horror. He's in a few Rob Zombies. He's also in the remake of The Hills Have Eyes.
Eyes, yeah.
He is... You cannot get a character actor as good as this. This is like one of those character actors that, like, you know, turns up, gets told what to do, and then steals the show.
Was he in The Warriors?
I don't think he was in The Warriors.
Are you sure?
But I'll have to double check that.
Face. Was
he? I know he does, definitely. But one of the stories that he saw, like, so the where I got the story of how Brian De Palma did that, the Battleship Potemkin stuff, was actually from an interview with him, and he basically broke it down. But not only that, he used to say that because they were filming in Chicago, he would constantly get people coming up to him and being like, oh, can we get a picture of you? And it's like, okay, cool. And then he'd find out later that, oh, that was the grand's, they wanted a picture of with the grandchild and you because they're related to the Needy family. And he was treated like royalty around all of Chicago and like taken out to blues bars and all of that stuff and treated as if he was Needy because they were sort of like, hey, you know, you're doing us a service and all that stuff. Come on, let's go party and all of that stuff. And of course, he wouldn't say no.
For our listeners that may be strange to what we're talking about, Battleship Potemkin was a seminal propaganda movie. Let's say black and white movie, and this movie pays a huge homage to it in the stairway sequence. So it's a series of set pieces that needs to be watched. It was parodied by Naked Gun. I can't remember which one. Yep.
I think was it was the first.
Was it the first one?
It might. Yeah,
maybe I remember it being parodied, but I can't remember which one.
Basically, it's definitely not the third one.
Okay, I'm still here, but you guys can see me on camera, so you know what I'm doing. I'm actually going through Billy Drago's acting career. Man, he's in Supernatural as well.
Yeah,
he's in an episode of Supernatural. He's in a bunch of stuff. Is he still alive and working?
No, he's not. He passed in 2019 he passed.
Oh, he almost worked all the way until he probably got sick. 2014 it was his last credit. But I wanted to just check if he was in The Warriors, a movie that keeps being mentioned by us, so we need to watch it at some point.
Oh, yeah.
We do.
The Warriors,
yeah. Man, he played Lucky Luciano in a movie called The Outfit, which has 3.4 on IMDb, which doesn't matter.
Well, his biggest thing is one of his first roles was he was in Pale Rider, and he was shot by... Clint Eastwood. He's got this whole story of how the squib on his neck didn't work properly. But if we ever cover Pale Rider, we can talk about it then.
Okay. Speaking of squibs, did you know that this is one of the little bits of trivia you guys can go and gather, or you can listen to our episodes because we do the gathering for you people. Apparently, Sean Connery got injured on set during the sequence.
Yeah.
And a lot of the blood from his death went into his eyes from the death sequence. And they had to carry him to the hospital. But apparently, De Palma had to beg him
to do it again.
He stole the paramedics to do another shot of the take. And Connery went, all right. I can't do a good Connery.
That's okay.
What is it? What was that?
I wasn't doing it right. Don't worry. I wasn't doing it right. Can I just say
you're so selfish, Mr. De Palma.
When he...
If you were a woman, I'll slap you.
Oh, my God.
You saw that interview, right?
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
That kind of put a... He was still a great actor, but that he really spoke out of turn. I was having this conversation with someone older. They went, there were different times. I'm like, what are you talking about, man?
We're
back in our place.
That scene where he gets shot by Needy and all that stuff, I actually laughed out loud at that because
the Tommy gun. It did a proper bullet dance.
No.
The dive? Are you talking about the dive?
It wasn't even the dive. It was when Kevin Costner comes in and he's like, "What is it? What is it, Malone? What is it?" And he goes, reaches for something, and he gets given the necklace,
and he's like, "No,
what are you prepared to do?"
I was like. How did they keep a straight face during that scene with him going, no, what is it?
It's fucking great. Like, what is it? What is it, Lassie? What is it, Lassie?
Get out of my face.
From a trivia kind of point of view, I did want to point out that Marlon Brando was originally offered 2 weeks' work to play.
Joking.
Al Capone?
Al Capone, yeah.
Okay, and this should lead you into your little factoid about Bob Hoskins.
Well, no, you can do the Bob Hoskins.
No, you can do the Bob Hoskins thing, because you sent me the reel about it.
Oh, my God.
Ricky, you know this, right?
Yeah, I got Steve Have sent you it seen to the... me separately.
Take the lead, Steve. Tell us about what is it about Bob Hoskins, Steve?
Why didn't you tell us?
Let's keep interrupting him. Tell us about Bob Hoskins, man.
So Marlon Brando refused $5 million for 2 weeks' work. 2 weeks' work to just be
the horror.
Which leads me straight into another person who could have possibly played Al Capone, which is Bob Hoskins. And one of the reasons why
you want to tell our listeners where you found this information, or you want to send them the reel? Well, we probably are going to have 3 people listening, so you can do it individually. We'll probably know them as well. Send it on WhatsApp to the people that are listening to the show. Ask Steve, please send him a message after you listen to this, and he will send you the real in question.
Umba first brought this up to me, and that went for me looking for this clip. So thanks, Umba, for bringing up.
You are more than welcome, sir.
Because I can remember that nugget where Bob Hoskins was originally offered role, but I couldn't remember why, and I couldn't remember what became of it, that kind of situation. So
tell us, we're hanging, man. Right. Tell us.
Well,
you went full walk in there.
We're walking.
Let's just go.
It's gonna break.
Go. So basically, he was paid a three-figure sum to basically sit on his ass and do nothing, only to just get, if it doesn't work out, would you like to be it? And he opened his mail one morning, and there was a check for a three-figure sum, which is quite a nice...
From De Palma, directly?
From De Palma, directly.
How much for?
I think it was 2,000... 2,000?
No, it was
200,000.
I'm looking now. $200,000. You know what? You sent me the reel.
I sent you a reel.
Yeah. How does it end? Because he does say, it's a great way to end that interview. He turns around to, what was the guy in the
Terry Wogan. Terry Wogan. Who's a really big name in the UK for interviews and stuff like that. And he was quite a comical chap as well. But Bob Hoskins basically turns around and gives Brian De Palma a call and says, is there any other movies you'd like me to
do? That's great, man. $200,000 for doing nothing. Back then as well. So with inflation, that's great. So I actually believe that story. I like Bob Hoskins, man.
Yeah. That movie.
He's always good. It was in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. That was my introduction to him as a kid.
Not Mario Brothers.
Best Mario Brothers.
Well,
right?
The best one. Believe it or not, we have different taste on things.
The Illumination Super Mario Bros. Is the best. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yes, it's great. Yeah.
Oh,
it's,
more DNA share there, because John Leguizamo was also in that, and he was in Khalil's Way. Benny Blanco.
Let's get Brian De Palma all over this.
But wait, there's more. There is one thing about Bob Hoskins. I'll mention this if you guys have seen this. One of my favorite English directors is Shane Meadows. Most people listening to the show know this name because of This Is England. And, it's a masterpiece. But I like his work, and I like the way his work changes over time. Like, for example, I never used to listen to the Stone Roses, and all of a sudden I watched Like a Stone, which is a documentary about the Stone Roses by a Stone Roses fan, which is Shane Meadows, and it's phenomenal. After watching that, I was riveted to the point in which I started listening to the Stone Roses back catalog. He made me a fan, basically. Okay. But there was a movie that made me fall in love with Shane Meadows way before This Is England. And the movie in question was 24/7. I don't know if you remember this. It was a black and white movie. And Bob Hoskins, I think he plays a football coach in it.
Yeah.
And he's phenomenal. His performance is just... So if you... We're going to go back. And probably, if we're going to do a Shane Meadows movie at some point, we'll probably have to do Dead Man's Shoes.
Yes.
I think.
Oh, yeah.
I was hoping you would say something like Dead Man's Shoes. I wouldn't mind, actually... At some point, doing like the This Is England, like whole
as a whole, as
like
a whole,
the
yeah.
TV stuff as well.
Yeah, yeah, the movie and then the TV stuff.
The Hitchcockian suspense of the stair scene. It reminded me of a phrase that was said by Hitchcock, which was, and I think he was talking about Marnie, where it's like what he did was he showed the suitcase going underneath the table. You don't know what's in the suitcase. Yeah. And then you see like the close-up of like the actress' face as she's really terrified. And then you see the clock. And it's all of that, like, no one's actually saying what's in the suitcase, but from these like shots of like worry and time and all of that stuff, you know that it can't be good. It's got to be a bomb. It's got to be whatever it is. And it's the same thing with the stair scene. There's so much going on in the stair scene, so much close up, so much worry, so much like, and then like seeing the baby was like a sort of like, oh my God, this can't go right. None of this can go right.
The tension, you know, it's funny. Okay, you're writing, so wait a second, you're writing mentioning this. When we're watching it with Steve, I turned around and I said, we both agreed immediately. I said to him, we both know what's going to happen here. We've seen this movie several times, and yet, I'm on the edge of my seat.
Yeah.
It's fucking...
Yeah.
And it's almost comical because if you took it a little bit, there's so many set pieces that you think it's because of the amalgamation of the memory that we have with Naked Gun as well. It's like it's too much. It's like John Wick and falling down the stairs 40 fucking times.
Yeah.
Go on, Steve, what were you saying?
I was just about to say, and John Wick.
And John Wick, that's it. And it was a staircase as well. Yeah. So there you go.
Like, and it's that scene, and you've pointed to it. It could have been too much, and it has been parodied and all of that stuff. But it had that Hitchcock style to it, that like no matter, as you're watching it, you're just constantly like, oh God, no. Oh no. Oh, it's and the mum's gonna get caught up in the crossfire, and oh God, no. And then it all starts off and it's amazing. Like all the slow-mo is worth it. Everything's really good.
Look, most of Hitchcock's work is fucking timeless, dude. No, it is like still the bar is raised so high. Like if you watch Vertigo again, it's got one of the scariest two frames at the end.
Even going back all the way to Phenomenal. Shadow of a Doubt.
Yeah, Shadow of a Doubt is a fucking masterpiece, so dude. Great. Come on,
so good.
Yeah, we're gonna have to do an episode about that one.
Shadow of a Doubt.
Welcome to this episode of Spirit Divers. Today we're talking about Shadow of a Doubt. Okay, I did this. So the one we do the episode, I do the same voice.
All right, cool. But my we're gonna get so many angry people.
Why? I don't give a shit.
They're gonna be like, is he trying to do Louis Armstrong? I really hope he's not trying to do Louis Armstrong.
No, what are you doing? What? Did I just do a voice blackface?
And like,
By the way,
we're all minorities here. Trying to do Louis Armstrong, not
we're
us.
All minorities.
Steve and I are clean, very clean. We weren't doing Louis Armstrong.
All minorities here. Steve is Welsh, definitely a minority. I'm Italian. You're sick, mate. Sick. How much are you getting on that in Australia, by the way?
Oh no, I'm not. You're sick, mate. I'm not because there was one day where I was sort of like, I'm an Indian background, and they're like, you're British. Shut up. You are British.
You're as Indian as curry, and curry is definitely
English.
No,
I'm as Indian as chicken tikka masala, which was in Birmingham. So, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
My final thing that I want to bring up about the film is the final line by Al Capone. Okay. Now, in terms of Robert De Niro.
You're nothing but talking about Edge.
That like my version of it started turning really weirdly Italian when I started doing
Offend an entire nation. Look at the badge. That's a soundbite for the end of the episode.
I'm talking about the badge.
You know how everybody's fucking holding him? Everybody's holding him and he's doing the fucking Goodfellas kick, but in the air.
Yeah. And he's just going, it's a talking badge. Anyway, what I found out, and so I said to Sal beforehand that one thing that I heard from a Marc Maron interview about Robert De Niro is that Robert De Niro is very much a sort of guy who doesn't really learn his lines. And it's fine because he's like done it for years and years.
He's method acting. Yeah. He's in there anyway. And I think when you hire him, you know to expect that.
Yeah.
Right?
So this whole thing that Marc Maron was talking about the Joker, because he's in the same scene as Robert De Niro in the Joker. And Marc Maron was sort of like, it was just really weird because like I'd just watch him and I'd be like, how is this gonna cut together? Because he was like really worried because Robert De Niro kept fluffing lines or kept going, I don't know what I'm saying next to off camera and all of this stuff.
Right.
And he was like, oh, how is this going to work? But then when you see it in the Joker, he knew that they were just going to cut around and take his best stuff and seam it all together.
Well,
he
probably took the experience from the King of Comedy with him.
But then I read up and I was like, okay, he's like, from that interview, I was like, oh, he's old, so whatever, you know, like maybe he's gotten into this state where it's like,
I hate that conversation. I think when you're old, you'll stop acting. Someone would stop. Otherwise, if you're on screen and you're that's mastery.
But
I think, yeah.
And then
have you seen Killers of the Flower Moon? He's fucking phenomenal in it.
Yeah, but you see, like,
dude, he's one of the most terrifying villains. No, we need to talk about that at some point, by the way, because
that's him like working with his best mate. That's him that's like brought him up and all of that stuff. And you know,
with Martin, he's working with Marty. Yeah,
and Martin not only knows how to work with him, but if Robert De Niro went off on a tangent, he'd be like, let's follow.
It's filming. Yeah, it's just filming.
But
Steve, have you seen it? Have you seen Killers of the Flower Moon?
Okay. I have not seen it.
It's Scorsese just swinging his big dragon tail for possibly the last few times, if not the last time. But he when he hits it, it's so hard that people that actually did not like the movie did not get it. Because the entire piece, the entire movie is the equivalent of you putting the concept of gaslighting into a blender and serve that as a smoothie once you're done. You serve it to the viewer going, this is, what's it called? What's the shake called? This is gaslighting. Have some. The essence, the villain that he plays in it is obviously synonymous for colonialism, right? That's the entire movie. But De Niro manages to channel this into a person, into a villain. And the way he does it is not just, it's so big that it's like, it's the villainy of, it's a tyranny of colonialism in one character.
We'll talk about this when we cover the movie. When we cover the movie, we'll talk about the actual novel as well as...
Yeah, of course, but I'm talking
go back to what I was saying about Robert De Niro. So I thought that whole thing...
Hey, it's not the first time that Scorsese adapted a novel for the screen, man. Let's be clear about that. What'd you think, man?
I thought that Robert De Niro on the Joker, that whole story was just for like the Joker and stuff. And then I went on a deep dive into the Untouchables, and it turns out that Robert De Niro didn't quite get a hold of all of his lines. That's me saying it quite nicely, to an extent that Brian De Palma would like basically between takes walk around behind him, forcing him to learn his lines, like literally reading the script to him and being like, you're saying this and you're saying this and you're saying, come mate, can we go over the lines again? You're saying this again. Please, can we just learn your lines, Bobby? Learn your lines, Bob, and all of this stuff, right? But so in that final scene of Al Capone, where he's saying, you know, you just talking about
talking about
talking
about
talking about
just talking about
just talking about
was that ad lib? Do you think
he forgot all his lines? He had a whole thing.
So that's why he repeated it over and over again.
He just repeated that.
You know what?
That's
funny you're saying. Yeah, there's actually two or three instances in which he repeats the same thing over again. What did I tell? I want his family dead. I want, which that's been, you remember that sequence, right? When he's ordering another hit basically on Ness.
Yeah.
And he's going, I want him dead. I want his family dead. Yeah. Like it's been parodied. I think there's a comedian called Pablo Francisco who's renowned for doing a very good Arnold impersonation.
Okay.
And it was about little tortilla boy. Do you remember that? Do you remember that?
No.
He's talking about a fictional movie with Schwarzenegger called Little Tortilla Boy. You got to get out of here. They're going to take my tortillas. And then it's like, and he does the typical, like, I smoked 1,000 cigarettes trailer voice in which he goes, one man in the city, you must fight to survive. And throughout that entire bit, I'll send you the reel on WhatsApp and to your listeners as well. You'll get a message from me as well. You can ask for this because you have my number.
All
yes.
You can just
message us and I'll send you on WhatsApp, not Facebook. No messenger on WhatsApp directly.
Because I know exactly who's listening to this. So,
but he basically, in this trailer about Schwarzenegger playing Little Tortilla Boy, who gets in trouble with the mob, he does a bunch of mob voices. And as we were watching The Untouchables the last time, I realized that that's where he got it from. Because he was going, I want him dead. I want his family dead. There's no other movie where it's done. The delivery is like that emphatic in the same way. It's a thing. I'll send you the reel later. Pablo Francisco.
Okay.
Okay. So very little of this episode will be shaved. Anything that you would like to say, Steve, conclude, take us to the bridge.
Are we rating?
We will.
Yeah, I was
actually,
just
going to
say.
Rick is right. Let's rate
it. Let's just rate it.
Yeah.
Is this a watch? It's one hell of a watch.
It's one hell of a
watch. I will watch it again every 2 years.
How many cigars? How many cigars are you giving this?
Out of five?
Out of
or 10?
Whatever.
I'd say 10. Let's do it out of 10.
10. Okay. It's a full box.
It's a full.
It's a full box for me. A
full box of cigars.
Yeah,
Cuban cigars like Andy Garcia's.
Just give me my doggy.
Absolute dog shit. say. What's your real name? Giuseppe Petri. Giuseppe Petri.
Yeah. Sorry, I am from Cuba.
It's a political refugee. Yeah,
I am from Cuba.
Anyway, he's great though, man. It's like, you got
don't
him.
Don't worry, son. I am Irish.
I got him. Dude, wait a second. Before we got Steve's rating, but we're going to go back a little bit. We're going to talk about the guy that plays the dude that gets shot in the head, right at the hand on the stairwell. That dude.
My God.
You know how he's gone with his teeth? He's like, he's fucking speeding off his fucking mind or something.
I wrote down, he is chewing the scenery. Scenery, literally.
Like, it's great, though. He's a great henchman. It's like a Batman henchman, almost.
Yeah. Really.
Yeah.
And the reaction of the guy that looks like John Hurt, which it's not. It's a Jackie or whatever his name is. The guy that plays that accountant. Mm. Steve is like, he knew. He goes, look at his face. Look at his face when he turns around and sees what happened. He knows he's going to talk in court. It's great because it's like, oh, he shot him right between the eyes. Yeah, Giuseppe Petri. I've got you.
Giuseppe.
That entire sequence between Garcia and I like this kid. Right after he insults him.
out of this episode, that has been the best Sean Connery impression. That one.
Oh,
right
well,
now.
Sorry. But I'm going to shave it off. Or shave it. Okay, so full box of cigars. Thank you, Steve.
Steve, was that the end of what you wanted to say about like why you're giving it a 10 out of 10?
Well, because we're just going over. And
no, don't worry about
it. To be honest, it ticks all the boxes. It's a fun movie to watch. It's got a great soundtrack. The score is phenomenal.
Mm.
Oh, my God. Just sitting
Dude,
there.
Can you believe? Do you remember I told you?
Yeah.
We were watching it. Because I was reading on IMDb before we did that watching, some prick in the comments I actually looked, dude. Yeah,
I know.
Fuck this guy. I'm gonna find out where he lives, man. There's somebody on IMDb when he led the entire review by saying, "Oh, the score was insistent and it was invasive," and I'm like, "What the fuck are you talking about?"
Oh my god.
You know,
what?
It wasn't the score that was meant to be on the film.
Of like, course. But yeah. Also, there's a little snippet. So they, in the trailer for this as well, they used his other nominated soundtrack for the trailer from the, was it The Mission?
Yes.
Yeah,
the Mission, is still Morricone.
But yeah, it's still Morricone.
Yeah,
but it's but there was a that's how they went down the road of getting him on.
There is one track from this. I'm pretty sure I didn't look it up, but there's one track from this where I remember I turned around to you, Steven. I said, "This isn't the thing." There is a bit, obviously, you know, most of the music in the thing is my Morricone, but there is one piece of music in particular that it's in there. It's in the thing for sure. Yeah. The Ricky, are you finished, Steve?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Ricky. Okay. So,
be very careful, mate.
I am very like okay.
No,
so
no, don't.
Oh my god! I've been waiting for this because I knew you guys like as soon as you guys like have been like messaging me and like being like yeah, and I've been like, oh my god, you guys are gonna hate me so bad.
Just fucking go, man.
So are you, so
you don't have to use the cigars as a rating system. You can pick your own, by the way. Go.
Oh my god.
Go.
So I'm afraid to say, guys, that I am going to be giving this a 7 out of 10. All right.
Well, that's not bad, acceptable. Man.
That's okay.
Acceptable.
That's better than mystery man.
Better than mystery man. So one of the things that happened to me, So I watched this week, but I also had watched it like about a year and a half ago or something like that. And when we watched it a year and a half ago, I remember having this feeling of dread in me, being like, why am I not enjoying this film? And by the end of the film, I was like, oh no, it's great. It's great. And I had this same dread this week. I like sat down and I started watching it and I'm like, oh God, this is what is, and there's just so many parts of this film early on that made me go, I'm going to be giving this a 5. I might even be ending up giving it a 4. But then
it ties up towards the end.
Exactly. Yeah. Then you have got the last like quarter, maybe the last 2/5 of the film that are just pounding. Point after point, it's still a bit cheesy and it's still, there's still a few choices that are made in this film that are a bit like, why is this even happening? And then
let's just say it's not historically accurate,
not at all.
Even then there's a few like very stilted bits in the in the start of it, like the whole reporter thing when they're going in, and there is a purpose to it. I understand there's a purpose to it.
There's a purpose to every single part.
It's almost clinical when it comes down to the Chekhov's gun that we talked about earlier. This happened, it will hit you back later. This happened, it will hit you back later.
But like you see, like watching it and comparing it to some other Brian De Palma films, like of course Scarface and all of that stuff. Sort of like, why is this even happening? And then in the last 2/5 of the film, it just turns into an absolute powerhouse. So while watching it, I was like, oh God, this feels like a 5 or a 4. But by the end of it, I was like, okay, that was awesome, the last 2/5 of it. But because I felt a bit 5 out of 10 earlier on, I'm giving it a 7.
Yeah.
That's a good score, man. That's a good score.
It's still a good score.
And 7 what? Out of what?
Seven cannolis.
Cannolis. Ah, you racist prick. All right, that's fine. Right, okay. It's my turn, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I give this... I give this 9 bullets out of a clip for a Tommy gun that holds 10 bullets, which is a chip clip for a Tommy gun.
That's a very chip clip.
But it's a 9 out of 10 for me. And the reason why is because I have never felt as old as when I say these kids today or they don't make them like this anymore. That's the other one. They don't make them like this anymore. And they don't. They just don't. There's something about the practicality of a movie that in scope is huge. Just when even the entire Canadian sequence, you know, I was talking to Steve about it when because the book that he read, which I can't remember if I read it or not. Yeah, it's much fresher in your memory. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the entire Canadian sequence, and it's not really, it didn't really happen. And the fact that I believe that these people probably spent most of the time behind the desk pursuing this criminal. But the idea is that it's romanticized to an extent. Like when the music swells and the crane and the camera goes up on a crane shot and like the scope of this, you know, you got a guy with glasses on an accountant shooting like 5-6 guys with a shotgun. It's the entire thing. And even the comedic edge of some sequences that are quite dark, like Sean Connery picking up the guy who's already dead, thinking on his feet, like De Palma, by the way, because it seems to me that De Palma put a lot of himself into Malone's character, in my opinion. It's just the thinking on its feet, right? When he goes outside, picks up the body that is already dead, puts a gun in its mouth. Do you remember that entire sequence, right?
Oh, totally.
The outrage of the Mountie. If you change the tone of that sequence, it would have been a horror film. Like, it's terrifying, you know? Like, and even says to the guy, don't let him clean up until after he talked. I do not condone your methods, Mr. Ness.
And it's like, yeah.
The entire thing. Yeah. The one-liners that you don't think that would belong in a movie like this, and they don't, and yet they're there. You know, it was a joy to watch. The only reason why it doesn't get a 10, it's because it's based on historical events, and it's not historically accurate.
So I see it as a movie, and I see it as a movie I would want to watch again. And that's why I'm saying it's a 10 for me. If there's anything out of this, I know the history of The Untouchables quite well. I know certain aspects of this, but it's a movie. And that's what I take out of it. It's a movie. Is it a movie I'd recommend to somebody else? Yes. Is it a movie I enjoyed? Yes. Is it a tour de force of some perfect fucking camera work?
Yeah.
Yes. Has it got a great soundtrack? Yes. I mean, it ticks all those boxes, and it's over the top and ludicrous at points, and I love over the top and ludicrous.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a clout pleaser. You're not going to forget it, you know. And also, if you mention The Untouchables, that memory of a great movie is still very much alive in people's heads.
Yeah.
So that you know, we talked about, I said that I wasn't going to mention Mystery Man again, so I'm going to... Mystery Man.
Yeah.
The running time of Mystery Man was 2 hours and 1 minute. And this movie was 1 hour and 59 minutes. They are 2 minutes apart, and yet they are worlds away when it comes down to quality. Anyway, on that note, I think we're done for today, guys, and I think you're done with us as well.
Yeah.
Yeah? I'm talking to you, listeners. This was Umba.
This was Steve.
And this is Ricky.
Until next week, goodbye.
Come out here, Capone. You want to fight? You want to fight you and me right here? That's it. Come on. Somebody, are you afraid to come out from behind your men? You afraid to stand up for yourself?
You want to do it now? No. You want to go to mat now?
Come on, you son of a bitch.
What?
Easy.
You talk to me like that in front of my son? Yeah. Fuck you and your family.
Easy. Me? It's me. It's me. Not this way. You got nothing. You got a lot of talk in the past. You're here because you got nothing. You got nothing in court. You don't got the bookkeeper. You got nothing.